We do have a slight chance of showers today. Cloudy, then becoming sunny. High 60 to 64. Lows tonight in the upper 40s. For Sunday, sunny. High 72 to 75. Breezy. Southwest winds 10 to 20. Looking ahead to Monday, mostly sunny and warm once again with highs in the mid-70s. Mid-60s by Tuesday. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. And at 10, Back Porch Harmony with Jerry Bredeman. Right now, it's time for a weekend edition on KAXC.
Here's his own life. A successful black artist whose once abusive father comes back into his life. The son is outraged to see him.
You threw hurdles in front of me, and I jumped over. And now you want to take credit for my strong legs. I'm not going to give you credit for that.
And then, a last album from the Japanroids. First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, October 19, 2024.
For KAXE News, I'm Chelsea Perkins with the Up North Report. Former 8th Congressional District Representative Rick Nolan has died at the age of 80. A news release from the Minnesota DFL party announced Nolan's death, which occurred Thursday night at his Nisswa home. An outpouring of remembrances from colleagues on both sides of the aisle and friends flooded social media in the wake of the unexpected news Friday morning. Former DFL State Representative John Ward of Baxter says he's thankful for Nolan's role in his life as both a fellow politician and a longtime friend.
Every time you had a conversation with Rick, you know, you just felt like you were the most important person in the world. And he always left your conversation by saying, you know, I love you. And even giving you a kiss on the cheek. I'll never forget that. I'll never forget the compassion and the love that Rick showed for others.
State Senator Grant Hochschild points to Nolan's legacy as a statesman who not only got along with people who held different political beliefs, but did not back down from challenging his own party.
He could navigate Congress and navigate the federal level to figure out, regardless of, again, that partisanship, regardless of who the administration was in the White House, he would find ways to make sure that what Northern Minnesota needed happened.
Former 2nd District Congressman Jason Lewis, a Republican who served at the same time as Nolan, shared a video from an unplanned 2017 road trip with Nolan after a canceled flight in Washington, D.C. The pair found agreement on an issue of the day and joked together about the airline situation.
They bought the pizza after we left.
Yeah, I know.
You haven't noticed that?
Yeah, they thought they were going to appease us with cold pizza.
You know what? And you're the Democrat. You're the one that should have got the free lunch.
Well, exactly.
Nolan grew up in Brainerd and graduated from Brainerd High School. And early in his political career, he served as a staff assistant to Walter Mondale in the U.S. Senate. He was a member of the State House of Representatives from 1969 to 1973 and represented the 6th Congressional District from 75 through 81. He returned to politics in 2012 to challenge first-term incumbent Congressman Chip Kravac, winning the race to represent the 8th, where he served through 2019. He leaves behind his wife Mary Nolan, 3 children, and over a dozen grandchildren. He is preceded in death by his daughter, Catherine Nolan Benson. A 22-year-old Virginia man died in a vehicle rollover Friday morning. The St. Louis County Sheriff's Office reports it responded to the crash in Pike Township, west of Embarrass. Deputies found Anthony Hall dead in the car. Hall was driving southbound on Highway 21 when he lost control, rolling the vehicle and hitting a tree in the ditch. A 33-year-old man charged with felony domestic assault escaped from a Hibbing hospital Thursday before being caught Friday morning. The St. Louis County Sheriff's Office says LaRon Lindell Brown reported chest pains to jail staff and was being seen at the Fairview Range Medical Center under guard of a deputy. Upon being cleared to return to the county jail in Hibbing, Brown escaped on foot. He was later taken into custody around 10:30 Friday morning by Hibbing police and is back in the county jail. The Sheriff's Office says additional charges for the escape are pending. The Superior National Forest says a quickly contained wildfire was detected in the forest on Thursday evening. Megan Buffington has more.
The Pfeiffer Lake Fire burned 8.5 acres of timber slash north of Big Rice Lake, southeast of Cook. The fire was 100% contained by early Friday afternoon. The forest says it is suspected to be human-caused, but an official investigation has not yet occurred. The fire is the fourth in the forest this fall. Open fires are not allowed anywhere within the Superior National Forest boundaries as dry conditions continue. The latest report from the U.S. Drought Monitor shows areas of severe drought expanded in the state, despite measurable rainfall in the Northeast over the weekend. Friday fire weather forecasts from the National Weather Service's Fargo and Duluth offices predict humidity to increase over the weekend, though above-average temperatures will remain and periods of gusty winds are possible. Megan Buffington, KAXE News.
That's it for the Up North Report from the KAXE News Desk. I'm Chelsea Perkins, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. Former President Trump spoke at the Al Smith Dinner in New York City Thursday night, a dinner to raise money for Catholic charities and often a regular stop every election cycle for political candidates.
Tradition holds that I'm supposed to tell a few self-deprecating jokes this evening. So here it goes. Nope, I've got nothing.
Well, he did have one line about how happy he was to appear in New York without a subpoena. NPR senior editor, correspondent Ron Elvin joins us now. Ron, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
Maybe not many self-deprecating jokes, but Donald Trump made several personal and in a couple of instances salacious japes, not sure they can be called jokes, in front of the Cardinal and aimed at his political opponents. Did his speech go, I have to say, beyond the bounds of decency? And what does that say about political discourse these days?
It says we're still very much in the age of Trump. He's setting the tone once again, just as he's been doing for nearly a decade. Here's one of his lines from this week's Al Smith.
Right now we have someone in the White House who can barely talk, barely put together two coherent sentences, who seems to have mental faculties of a child, it said. Is a person that has nothing going, no intelligence whatsoever, but enough about Kamala Harris.
So that was one of the lines that people can judge for themselves whether it's out of bounds or good, clean fun. But what some people consider boorish is what others call keeping it real or telling it like it is. And it's been a big part of Trump's impact on our political discourse. So Harris skipped the event. She sent a video instead, and she used that to take a couple of jabs at Trump, saying that his lies about the election violated the bearing false witness clause of the Ten Commandments. Trump said that was disrespectful, but her campaign may have decided overall there was little upside in seeing her there.
Also this week, Donald Trump danced for half an hour during a town hall. He refused to answer some questions at an appearance at the Chicago Economic Club. Backed out of a CNBC interview. Is this causing any concerns among his supporters about his fitness for high office?
It's probably more disturbing to Harris voters than Trump voters, who are more or less accustomed to taking these things in stride. And lately, it extends to these last-minute cancellations. You mentioned CNBC. He also stiffed CBS's 60 Minutes. One of his campaign staffers has been quoted saying that he's cutting back on his schedule because he's exhausted. And at times, at least, he has seemed so. NBC posted a video last night that appears to show Trump nodding off, eyes closed, head bobbing at one of his own campaign events. On the other hand, you have the more aggressive media strategy, as we saw this week at the end of a 20-minute segment on Fox and Friends, the morning show. He announced he was going that day to meet with Rupert, meaning Rupert Murdoch, the man behind all things Fox. We already knew that Trump has been upset with the number of Harris surrogates and ads that have appeared on Fox, and Trump said he was going to ask Rupert, as he called him, to cut these off and cut off negative ads for the rest of the campaign, adding, "Then I think we'll have the victory."
Meanwhile, Kamala Harris was on Fox News, probably not what most pollsters would call her demographic. What did you see in her appearance?
Here again, it depends on which camp you ask. Trump folks tended to say she had been exposed and evasive. Harris folks were proud of how she faced the slings and arrows and interruptions and held her ground on Fox. They were also pleased just with the contrast, Harris going on Fox while Trump was canceling interviews and complaining about fact checkers and tough questions.
And NPR's Ron Elving, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
What might the killing of the architect of the October 7 attacks, Yahya Sinwar, mean for the conflict between Israel and Hamas? And Pierce Adil Shalchi joins us now from Tel Aviv. Adil, thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you.
We're learning more about the circumstances around the killing of Sinwar, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly. So I'll just let you know that Israeli military has actually been chasing Sinwar for more than a year now, and they finally got him, but by chance. So what happened is the military said on Wednesday that they were shooting at some Hamas militants running into a building in southern Gaza. And then a drone video showed a wounded man sitting inside the building, his face covered, and then he threw a stick at the drone, and the military shelled that building, destroying it. Then troops found a body in a bulletproof vest with grenades, surrounded by $10,000 in cash. And then after that, DNA tests and dental records later identified that the body was Sinwar's. You know, Hamas came out on Friday calling his killing, quote, painful and distressing. But the militant group was defiant. It said, however many of our leaders you kill, it won't sway us and we'll get right back on our feet. And then Iran's supreme leader also chimed in this morning. He said on X, quote, Hamas is alive and will stay alive.
What might Sinwar's death mean for Hamas?
So, like, on the political side of things, some names like Hamas's political chairman, Khaled Mish'al, or Sinwar's deputy, Khalil al-Hayye, have been mentioned to take his place. They've been representing Hamas outside Gaza for years in Qatar and are known as more willing to compromise. Militarily, things may not change so much. Sinwar's brother, Mohammed, has been running field operations, so if he is still alive, we may see some of those same guerrilla tactics Hamas has been using. But, you know, Hamas is a group that fights to become martyrs. And some Palestinians blame Sinwar for inviting war and destruction of their homes. But now others are claiming him as a hero, someone who was killed fighting the Israelis above ground and not, in fact, hiding in a tunnel at the time of his death.
Of the hostages taken on October 7th, 101, I guess, are still held in Gaza. Dozens of them might be alive. What would Sinwar's death mean for them?
Right. So this week, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that he'd guarantee the safety of anyone who returns the hostages. And then, of course, the relatives of these hostages, they just want to see an immediate deal to secure their release. They want action now. But there's also serious worries that Sinwar's killing could actually backfire on the hostages. You know, they could be killed as revenge. So it's possible that also with Sinwar's death, any real knowledge of who might be holding these hostages and where becomes more vague and uncertain.
Ultimately, Hadil, are ceasefire talks to end the war more likely now?
I mean, so with Sinwar gone, there could be some flexibility. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is on his way to the region this week. But both Hamas and Israel will have to come to serious compromises if they want to make it happen. But let's not forget, there's a whole other conflict to consider. Up north, Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon are trading fire. Israel struck Beirut and launched a ground incursion. It says that it wants to root out Hezbollah. And then it also seems like Sinwar's killing has made Hezbollah more defiant. It said it's entered a new escalatory phase in its war against Israel and that it even has some new types of weapons. You know, so far today, the Israeli military says at least 180 projectile rockets have been fired from Lebanon into northern Israel. And then police also said that a drone was launched directly at Netanyahu's home in Caesarea. The government did say that Netanyahu was not in the house and no one was hurt.
NPR's Hadiel Al-Shalchi in Tel Aviv. Thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
You'd think New York's Mayor Eric Adams would want to avoid setting off new controversies. He's been indicted on 5 counts of bribery, wire fraud, and soliciting illegal foreign campaign donations. There have been numerous investigations and resignations of his closest aides and calls for his own resignation, and the mayor is up for re-election next year. But this week at New York's Columbus Day Parade, Mayor Adams pulled on a cap with the New York Mets logo on one side and New York Yankees on the other. Both teams are in the playoffs of their respective leagues. If Mayor Adams hoped to strike a sweet chord for municipal harmony, it went sour. People on X had thoughts. Another charge to the indictment. This hat is the worst thing Eric Adams has done to the people of New York City. And almost predictably, lock him up! New Yorkers can be a tough crowd, and it wasn't even a Red Sox cap. I'm actually astonished that a furious fan of either club didn't try to cover over the mayor's two-logoed chapeau with a well-aimed bagel and a schmear. Mayor Adams now stands accused of being what amounts to a phony by purporting to be both the Mets and Yankees fan. The mayor's office says it's vintage merchandise from the 2000 World Series between the Mets and Yankees, which the Yankees won 4-1. I think I can understand why the mayor of one of just two cities in this country where what they call a subway series is possible would cheer for both his city's clubs to be contenders. A Yankees-Mets series would lighten the hearts of citizens in all 5 boroughs. It would mean good business for local delis, bars, and souvenir vendors who sell those big puffy hands with upraised index fingers to declare, "We're number one!" Subway series would fill the 4 and 7 trains with Mets and Yankees fans going back and forth between the Bronx and Queens game to game, smiling at one another in a shared civic spirit of sportsmanship and fair play. Okay, maybe that last point's a little optimistic, but whatever he intended to show by wearing his two-sided cap, I think Mayor Adams just seemed to confirm a perception many people have, that politicians can talk out of both sides of their mouths, and this week, from both sides of a baseball cap. East Side, West Side, and you're listening to NPR News.
Good morning. It is 7:18. You're listening to Weekend Edition on KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of every month. If you have questions or are interested in joining the board, you can contact us at 218-326-1234 during weekday business hours. The board's full meeting schedule is online at kaxe.org. We have a slight chance of showers today. Cloudy to start, then becoming sunny with highs 60 to 64. Lows tonight in the upper 40s. Sunny tomorrow, highs 72 to 75. Breezy southwest winds 10 to 20. Looking ahead to Monday, mostly sunny, highs in the mid-70s. BSU Opera Theater presents Marriage of Figaro tonight at 7:30. The performance will be at the Bangsburg Fine Arts Complex on the Bemidji State Campus. Zion Lutheran Church in Grand Rapids has a meatball and lefse dinner next Saturday night, October 26, from 4 to 6:30. Proceeds go toward the maintenance of Camp Hiawatha and for kids to attend camp.
Live from NPR News, I'm Dwali Saikautau with these headlines. Ukraine has announced a new prisoner exchange with Russia involving a total of 190 prisoners of war, including Ukrainian human rights activist and service member Maxim Bukovich. The South Korean National Intelligence Service says North Korea has sent some 12,000 troops to Russia's Far East for training to fight against Ukraine. The Institute of War out of Washington, D.C. says intelligence sources appear to be consistent with new video footage. And the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ceremony returns to Cleveland, Ohio, known as the birthplace of rock and roll. The 16 inductees include Ozzy Osbourne, Foreigner, Kool and the Gang, Cher, and Mary J. Blige. I'm Dwali Saikautau, NPR News in New York.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose mission is to assess practitioner competency to create design solutions that safeguard public health, safety, and welfare. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. And from the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Over 10 million ballots have already been cast in the 2024 election, 2.5 weeks before what we still call Election Day. Early voting is underway in many states, and in one of the biggest swing states, the rush to the polls has been big.
A record-breaking first day of voting in the battleground of Georgia today.
More than 305,000 people cast their ballot Tuesday, more than 2 times the number in the past 2 election cycles.
Michael McDonald joins us. He's a professor of political science at the University of Florida, who specializes in American elections. He joins us from Gainesville. Thanks so much for being with us.
Wonderful to be with you.
Has there been a growth in early voting?
Oh, yeah. I mean, over 1 million people have already voted in Georgia. We're seeing big numbers elsewhere as well. They're not as big as they were in 2020 because the pandemic was a very unusual election, and we had record numbers of people who were casting mail ballots. But if we look at the longer trend line, yes, these are numbers that look increasingly over from election to election, setting aside that 2020 election.
And what do you think we can learn or infer from this turnout?
Well, from the vote-by-mail states, we're going to know something about the turnout overall in the country. In 2020, I could see that we were surpassing the total vote cast in 2016 in the early vote alone the week before the election. And indeed, in 2020, the turnout rate was the highest that we had seen since 1900. So we're looking fairly robust right now in terms of participation. At the moment, I'm shading our turnout more towards the 2020 record turnout than, say, the 2016, which was still very high.
What do you caution people we shouldn't infer or assume from all the early voting?
Well, we're already seeing, as we normally see, that the Democrats are voting early. We expect that to happen because Democrats prefer to vote early, and the Democrats have to build up a seawall. And then on Election Day, we see that red wave come in. And then the question is, will that seawall that the Democrats have built, is that going to be enough to withstand the red wave that's going to happen on Election Day? So just because the Democrats are leading at this moment, that's not to say that Harris is going to win the presidency. We still have a long ways to go, and of course we need to see Election Day.
Why the assumption that it's the Democrats who are voting early?
I've followed this since 2008, and every year we see more Democrats vote early than Republicans. In fact, I mean, if you're in a state and you don't see that pattern, it's almost a sure indication that the Republicans are going to win whatever state offices there are for that election cycle. Why is it? It's a good question. In more recent years, of course, we've had President Trump disparage early voting in its various forms, and his supporters have listened to him. This time around, he has softened his language on early voting. And it's actually, it looks like it's happening in the data. We can see more Republicans than we have in typical past elections voting early. Maybe this advantage that the Democrats have had since 2008, maybe it won't be as significant as this year as we've seen in the past. But again, we still have a long ways to go.
What are you watching for at this point in the election as we get reports about mail-in voting?
Again, we expect the Democrats to do well and pile up early votes. So that's what's happening. That's the expected thing. What I'm seeing at the moment is that not only are the more Democrats voting, they're also returning those mail ballots at a higher rate than the Republicans who have requested those mail ballots. So it looks like there's some level of enthusiasm that's lurking inside these numbers. Republicans tend, at least in the past, to have voted later in the cycle. So we'll have to see if this persists. But right now, that's the most interesting thing to me of what's going on.
I have to ask Professor McDonald, do you ever tell people, well, why don't we wait until we count the ballots?
I do say that. I mean, I've been trying to say that. I mean, we know that the Democrats are going to build up a lead in the early vote if typical past patterns occur, and then we're going to see what happens on Election Day. So, yes, I firmly believe that we need to wait till everyone has voted to actually know what the outcome is going to be.
Michael McDonald is a political science professor at the University of Florida. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be with you.
Some gyms make people cancel their memberships by certified mail. It can take an hour on the phone to try and drop a cable provider. Federal regulators get numerous complaints like these every day and have finalized a rule to try to make it easier for consumers to get out of these commitments. NPR's Alina Selyuk gets into the fine print.
The basics of the rule are straightforward. Canceling subscriptions or memberships must be as easy as signing up. And companies have to be fully transparent about the terms of any free trial or discounted subscription before asking for payment.
We've tried different approaches in the past. Companies are just not getting the message.
Sam Levine runs the Consumer Protection Bureau at the Federal Trade Commission, which passed the rule. He spoke to NPR's Planet Money podcast.
They know exactly what they're doing. They're using some of the most sophisticated design techniques available to trap people in these subscriptions and manipulate them.
The FTC says it receives around 70 complaints about this every day. A woman from Arizona wrote it took her 20 minutes to join a gym and more than 3 days to cancel that membership. A senior citizen said they had to call 3 times to cancel one magazine subscription. Someone once described an essential oils company demanding a portion of a social security number to cancel. TikTok is rife with these stories.
You basically have to remove your kidney just to cancel the frickin' subscription.
Are you sure you want to cancel? How about 15% off? How about 30% off? How about no, I hit the cancel button? This is crazy.
In recent years, the FTC has taken a few companies to court, including Amazon and Adobe, accused of tricking people into paid memberships that were purposefully difficult to cancel. The new rule now says online subscriptions should require the same amount of clicks to cancel as they do to enroll, and in-person signups must have an option to cancel online or over the phone. Levine also says the rule begins to shift the financial incentive by giving federal regulators more power to fine violators.
Companies that engage in subscription traps will be liable for civil penalties of more than $50,000 per violation. And every time you trap a consumer in a subscription, is a potential violation.
Numerous business groups and the FTC's Republican commissioners have opposed the new rule. They've argued that the agency overstepped its legal authority to pass new burdensome requirements. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce called it a regulatory power grab to micromanage business decisions. Most of the rule's requirements will go into effect in about 6 months, and it's likely to eventually get tested in court. Alina Selyuk, NPR News, Washington.
We're going to ask Moussa Babu-Touha to read the beginning of his poem, Younger Than War.
Tanks roll through dust, through eggplant fields, beds unmade, lightning in the sky, brother jumping to the window to watch warplanes, clouds of smoke after airstrikes, warplanes, eagles searching for a branch on which to perch. No need for radio. We are the news.
In the midst of war in Gaza following Hamas's October 7, 2023 attack on Israel, Moussab Abu-Touha has a new book of poetry, Forest of Noise. The Palestinian poet, teacher, and writer who recently won an Overseas Press Club Award for his Letters from Gaza in The New Yorker joins us now from Syracuse, New York. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Scott, for having me.
As your poem notes, Gaza and Gazans are in the news so much in the West. What do you hope these poems might help depict that the news may not?
Well, what the news is doing is depicting a list of names. If someone has his names on the news, he's lucky to be recognized as a person with a name or an age. But what the news failed to do is to mention that these people existed as individuals, people with their dreams, their hopes, their previous lives, their family relationships. What the news does not recognize is that these people are not dying by themselves. They die with their children, their grandchildren, sometimes with their grandparents. So it's really devastating that the news generally does not recognize these facts, which I, as a Palestinian, know very well because I lost 31 members of my extended family in one airstrike on October 14th. And I didn't get the chance to see these people to bid them farewell.
Well, let me ask you to read another one of your poems. May I ask you to read your poem, No Art?
Yeah, sure. No art. The art of losing isn't hard to master, Elizabeth Bishop. You know everything will come to an end, the sugar, the tea, the dried sage, the water. Just go to the market and restock. Even your shadow will abandon you when there is no light. So just keep things that require only you. The book of poems that only you can decipher. The blank map of a country whose cities and villages only you can recognize. I've personally lost 3 friends to war, a city to darkness, and a language to fear. This was not easy to survive, but survival proved necessary to master. But of all things, losing the only photo of my grandfather under the rubble of my house was a real disaster.
What's the power of a poem now? Why do you devote yourself to poetry?
Well, I mean, the power of the poem is that it preserves and it delivers the power of the experience and also the emotions and the feelings that come with it. So what I'm doing is documenting what I'm seeing and witnessing and also how I'm feeling, the devastation, the hopelessness, the fear. Because what happened to the people in the book could have happened to me. The girl whose body remained under the rubble for about 10 months. And when we removed the rubble, stone after stone, and we found only a bone, that could be my daughter.
I have to ask you a tough question. Do you think there are Israelis who have similar stories, particularly after October 7?
Yeah, I mean, I know that there are some Israelis who lost family members and who lived through horrible things. But the thing that I cannot compare here, what happened to Israelis on October 7th and what has been happening for us in Palestine for 76 years. I was born in a refugee camp. I was not born in Jaffa, the city where my grandparents were expelled from. My parents themselves were born in refugee camps. And I told you, I lost 31 members of my extended family. I am one person. And I can't even think about the Israeli suffering because I have suffered all my life. I recognize that they suffer, but you can't bring this to me as a Palestinian who has lost 40,000 people. The last one was my student, Hatem Azza'anin. He was killed while he was looking for firewood in Beit Hanun, North Gaza. How can I happen to think now what happened on October 7th on one day? And now after a year, we are just trying to think about what happened to the Israelis.
Do you see an end?
Yeah, the end will come when the United States stops supporting the genocide in Gaza. When you say that Israel has the right to defend itself, it's okay, I don't have any objection. You can say Israel has the right to defend itself. But when you, on the other hand, when you say that Israel has to minimize the civilian casualties, what did you do exactly? Did the United States do anything in order to force Israel to minimize civilian casualties? No, they never did that.
Mr. Abutoa, how are you and your family getting by now? How are you doing?
I'm not living a normal life. I'm just spending my time. I'm not living. There's a difference between living and spending time. I just imagine every day you wake up to watch the news. I was traveling from South Africa back to upstate New York. It took me 16 hours in the flight. The moment I landed, I turned on my mobile data to see the names of the people who were killed. Just imagine, I'm doing this every day. Just every day I look for the last names, Abu Toha, no, we are good. I have been living this for a year. And I'm wondering how the United States, how the whole world really expect the people of Gaza to be like after this ends. Do they expect that these people would be normal?
Mosab Abu Toha is new collection of poems, Forest of Noise. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Scott.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. A Native American tribe in Central California has spent decades campaigning for a way to protect the coastal waters along its traditional territory. Now the Biden administration is creating a new National Marine Sanctuary, one the tribes will help manage. NPR's Lauren Summer has more.
Violet Sage Walker has been thinking about her dad a lot lately. For years, he had a vision for protecting the Central California coast. It's the historical homeland for his tribe, the Northern Chumash.
That's all my dad ever wanted, was that people would know that we are the stewards of this land, that we are still here.
Walker is chairwoman of the Northern Chumash Tribal Council. The coast north of Santa Barbara is known for its beauty. There's kelp forests, whales, sea otters. But for Walker, it's also home to many sacred sites, like the rugged cliffs known as Point Conception.
And it's where we spiritually believe that all people leave this world into the next life. They take their journey, whatever faith you are, whatever spirituality you have.
10 years ago, Walker's father nominated the area to be considered for a National Marine Sanctuary. That means it would be protected, kind of like a national park or national forest.
One of the last conversations we had in the hospital before he passed away, he said the sanctuary was the most important thing that he ever did and that he wanted me to finish it.
It took years, but now it's a reality.
This is a really exciting time, an incredible achievement for ocean conservation on the central coast of California.
Paul Michelle works on marine sanctuaries at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He says the Chumash Heritage National Marine Sanctuary will be the third largest in the country. It will be protected from oil drilling and mining, and fishing will still be allowed. The final sanctuary is smaller than what was proposed because of new offshore wind farms that are being planned.
Not knowing exactly how many cables, how many substations, the exact routes. So this is all a balancing act, right? And this is what sanctuaries do.
Michelle says once the wind farm's infrastructure is built, NOAA will consider expanding the sanctuary. It will also be managed in partnership with several tribes and indigenous groups in the area, something NOAA is figuring out.
Really what this represents is a starting point, because we realize we've got a lot of work to do to get to know one another, to build some trust.
Under the Biden administration, tribes have started co-managing federal lands and waters in a handful of places, giving them a say over what was once theirs. After centuries of violence and displacement, Walker says there's a lot of repairing to do. Now, with climate change, she says protecting the natural world is more vital than ever.
As long as I'm breathing, we're going to be fighting to protect our earth. You know, that's just who most indigenous people are. So I'm always hopeful, always optimistic.
She just wishes her dad could see it.
I did what he asked me to do, and I think we did a pretty good job, too.
Lauren Summer, NPR News.
Tomorrow on Weekend Edition, Sunday, with Aisha, an ancient tomb unearthed in Petra, southern Jordan, that has 12 skeletons inside. It's quite a find for researchers who've had little information about the Nabataean people.
It's already showing us a view into the life and, of course, the death and the ritual practices of that time, right at the heart of that kingdom.
Hear more about the 2,000-year-old tomb tomorrow by asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. This is NPR News.
Thanks for listening to Weekend Edition on KAXE. Good morning. It is 7:39. I'm Jennifer Barr. We've received support from the Mental Health Crisis Response Team of Itasca County. This crisis intervention service is a program of first call for help 211 and provides free crisis assessments, stabilization services, referrals, and resourcing to residents of any age who are in crisis. They are available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by dialing 211. We have a slight chance of showers today, cloudy, then becoming sunny, high 60 to 64, lows tonight in the upper 40s, sunny tomorrow, highs 72 to 75, breezy, southwest winds 10 to 20. For Monday, mostly sunny, highs in the mid 70s. Northland Arboretum in Brainerd offers their haunted trail tonight from 7 to 9. There are low scare, high scare, and insane high scare options. Advanced tickets available at northlandarb.org. There's more ahead from Weekend Edition.
I'm Dwahali Saikautal in New York City with these headlines. On the first day of early voting in North Carolina, election officials say a record 353,000 people cast their ballots Thursday, surpassing 2020 numbers. This despite hard-hit areas still recovering from Hurricane Helene. In Sri Lanka's northeast, roughly 125 miles north of the capital, Colombo, a train carrying thousands of gallons of fuel hit a herd of wild elephants, killing two of the giant mammals. And in Japan's capital, police have arrested a man suspected of firebombing the ruling party's headquarters in Tokyo. No injuries were reported, and it isn't clear what the motive was for the attack. I'm Dwahali Saikautal, NPR News in New York.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sattva, committed to making handcrafted mattresses that help lull people to sleep and keep them sleeping soundly. More information is at SAATVA.com/NPR. From JTV, Jewelry Television, offering a variety of gemstone jewelry with more than 70 different gemstones available. JTV can be found on TV or at JTV.com. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. In the new film Exhibiting Forgiveness, Terrell is a successful Black artist who still wrestles with nightmares. Can't really call them dreams, about his father. And one day that father stumbles back into his life hoping for forgiveness.
There's some things I want to talk to you about.
Hey, let me explain something to you, man. I really don't want to be doing this anyway, but my mama asked me to, so here I am. Now, if you don't want to do it, I'll be more than happy to leave.
I'm not the same man you remember, Terrell.
I don't even know what that's supposed to mean.
All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God.
Yeah. We doing this?
Exhibiting Forgiveness is the first feature film from Titus Kaphar, the painter and sculptor whose own life inspires this film. We will certainly ask about that. It stars Andre Holland as Terrell alongside John Earl Jelks as Laron, his father, and Andra Day. Titus Kaphar joins us from our studios in Culver City, California. Mr. Kaphar, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
Is this an autobiography?
You know, it is not a direct autobiography. What I mean by that is I actually started this project before even the writing with a documentary. I sort of stumbled into that documentary. Mm-hmm. I was going back to Michigan to visit my grandmother. And when I showed up, I wasn't expecting to see him. And to my surprise, my grandmother insisted that I talk to him. I was trying to get out of the situation, so I said, if you want to talk to me, then let me film you. Thinking, of course, that he would say no, but he said, be at my house in 15 minutes, and that began that documentary. What happened is I finished it. I screened it one time publicly, decided I was not going to do that again, and I realized my dissatisfaction was from the fact that it did a really good job of explaining where we were, but not how we got there. And this film, utilizing the foundation of my story, but allowing fiction to come in and pull in some broader truths that would be more difficult to say if it was a documentary, this version of it is the version that I want to be in the world.
Why relive so much sadness and difficulty?
You know, there are moments of sadness and difficulty in this film, but ultimately this film is about hope and healing. I didn't want to put in every moment of hurt and pain. I wanted to create something that had balance, so I literally created a grid to make sure that there was balance, that I was telling a whole story. The other thing, honestly, Scott, is when I've shared this film at film festivals, people's responses have been heartening. We did a screening of this film at the Sidewalk Film Festival in Birmingham, Alabama. 2,000 people showed up for the premiere. And after the film, people from all walks of life, all races, were coming up to me saying, you know, that is my father too. That was my mother too. And they're finding themselves reflected in the film. There's something about that that feels like maybe this was worth that initial pain.
But I feel the need to explain. The father in this film is not just a jerk. He's cruel. He works his son to the bone to help pay for his drug habit. He ignores his son when the little boy is hurt. How were those scenes to shoot?
You know, those scenes were challenging, but when you watch the film, what you'll notice is none of those cliches that you normally see in these kinds of movies apply here. Mm-hmm. So there's a father who is struggling with addiction, and there's no drug use in the film. There is a struggle, a domestic abuse struggle, and there is no violence or harm done to express that. Mm-hmm. I gave myself parameters in my writing. I knew that as a person who struggles with getting images stuck in his own head, that I didn't want to be responsible for just dropping these kinds of things in other people's head. And the truth of the matter is, it was through the writing process that I've come to understand my father. If you had asked me when I was a young man, I would have told you that my father is the villain of my narrative. But when you sit down and you write a character, you have to put that character on the page and you have to be honest. You can't just make that person a villain. Yeah. There are no villains in the world that just do evil to do evil. We like to think that, but that's not the case. Usually what happens is people who do things that are harmful think they're doing something good. My father wanted to teach me a work ethic. He wanted to show me a way of getting through the world that he thought would be best. Now, my cousin said it best. He said, you know, you threw hurdles in front of me, and I jumped over. And now you want to take credit for my strong legs. I'm not going to give you credit for that. But what I will say is I would not be here without that experience.
Oh. One of my favorite scenes, and there is nothing complicated about it, unless I'm missing something, is Terrell making pancakes for his much-loved son and wife.
Daddy, can I get some pancakes?
No, baby, Daddy doesn't feel good right now.
Hey, Mommy, don't tell him.
Hey, come here, big boy. I got you.
I got you. Mm. You want some blueberries and pancakes?
Just pancakes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right,
come on.
Gosh, I love that scene.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you pointed that out, because there are all of those moments of hope. You know, we come from the backgrounds that we come from. And as a father, what I want most in the world is to create a future for my children that helps them be more whole. And so in the film, you get that from Terrell, that he and his partner have created this peaceful world for themselves. Even when the son Jermaine comes into the house and starts jumping on the couch, and
yeah.
You know, if I had come into my house jumping on my mother's couch, well, I won't tell you what would have happened. But that is not the way that it's handled in this household.
I feel the need to ask a question, and I would understand if you wanted to say just none of your business. How are you and your father doing?
My father is on his journey. He's on his journey to healing. And I, more than anybody, believe that he is going to make it there. And I am, like I said in the beginning, I've gained a compassion for my father that I didn't have before. And we are in contact. I'm also aware that the relationship may not look like what you might want it to look like, but this film and my life, I wasn't looking for a Hollywood ending. I was looking for something that reflected the truth.
Titus Kaphar, his feature film, Exhibiting Forgiveness, in theaters now. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
It's Japandroids, the indie rock duo, ripped open their debut full-length album called Post Nothing, with this exclamation. Fifteen years later, the band is leaving town, they say, but not before they release one last record. The album is Fate and Alcohol. It's part look back and part ponder forward, and it deals with life, fate, family, and yes, substance abuse. David Prowse is half of Japan Droids alongside Brian King. He joins us now from Vancouver. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So let's start at the end. Really, your last album?
Yeah, it's really our last album. This is not some sort of elaborate marketing stunt. It's our last album. I think Brian and I live in two different places geographically, and I think we're just sort of in different places in our lives. We started as very close friends, and we've kind of grown apart in a lot of different ways, and this seemed like a natural kind of time to close.
So you hear a track like this, D&T, a lot of energy there, isn't there, for a group that's calling it quits?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know any other way. That song's a good example of how things are changing with us. I mean, I think on the surface that sounds like a, you know, a quote-unquote classic Japan Droid song. You know, musically it's really energetic, feels pretty anthemic, but, you know, the lyrics tell a bit of a different story. It gives you a bit of insight into where Brian's head has been at in the last little while as he's making changes and, you know, maybe realizing that being the life of the party isn't all it's cracked up to be, especially as you get a little older.
Yeah. In fact, let's hear from the track Upon Sober Reflection. Don't wanna know. And Brian can't join us for certainly a joyful reason, right?
Yeah, that's right. He's like literally about to become a dad. So yeah, he's a little indisposed.
What do you think changed in his life, your life, together as musicians?
I mean, how much time do you have?
We're here, you know, for you.
Yeah, I mean, I think just like any other people, you grow, you change, you learn, and hopefully you learn as you get older. And I think Brian, it's hard for him to untangle music with sort of the darker things that have come along with it. And I think for now, he just needs to take a break from that whole world. And I'm still doing music stuff, but I've taken off my artist hat and I've put on a venue operator / promoter hat. I'm supportive of Brian. I'm glad he's a happier and healthier person today than he has been at some points in the past. And that means the end of this band, so be it.
Tell us about Gaslight Anthem.
That's the Dave song on the record. So, you know, I sing the lead vocal and I wrote the lyrics to that song. You know, it sounds pretty upbeat, but the lyrics come from a bit of a darker place. It actually comes from a friendship of mine with someone who struggled deeply with substance use. Mm-hmm. Not Brian. Darling, it's been a minute or so. had a friend who was much smarter than I was and always had a way of escaping, you know, some of those difficult conversations that I tried to have with them many times over. And yeah, it's just sort of talking about that frustration. She could use her amazing intellect, and this is one of the smartest, funniest people I've ever known in my entire life, but she could use that brain power to service her addiction rather than engage in like an honest conversation with a friend.
I've got to tell you, it's been my experience that sometimes somebody's intense intelligence works against them because they can just come up with more cunning reasons to do nothing.
100% agree with you on that.
I never pass up a chance to talk about my hometown.
But we see it in Chicago.
What led you to do this song?
Chicago is a place that we were both very fond of and had a real connection to. We've played there a million times and always had a great time there. So, you know, obviously the songwriting process is a little different from song to song with us, but a lot of them come with sort of a skeleton of a song that Brian brings in. Maybe it's just a handful of chords and maybe a chorus. Yeah, that one was kind of a pretty basic sketch of a song before we kind of dug into it together. And I just really liked that sort of that guitar rhythm that that Brian was introducing. And then that snare roll comes in. It's just something that I heard in my head immediately.
Don't got the word.
You're going to miss working together?
Depends on the day, you know? Yeah. I mean, you know, it's, I think making music with somebody is a pretty magical thing. And it's sad to think that that's not going to be a thing anymore. That said, I mean, making this last record was challenging for both of us. And I'll be able to really enjoy all the beautiful things about playing in a band together after I get a little bit more distance from it, you know? But yeah, that's my long answer. And the short answer is yes, I will miss it.
David Prowse of Japan Droids and band's final album, They've Convinced Me, Bait and Alcohol, out now. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Guy has always been a solo act, BJ Lederman, who writes her theme music. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing extraordinarily creative individuals with a track record of excellence. More information on this year's MacArthur Fellows is at macfound.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org.
It is just before 8 o'clock. You're listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. You may listen at KAXE.org or by asking your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you so much for your support. And our Come Home to KAXE Fall Membership Drive kicks off Monday. We'll be doing some concert ticket giveaways throughout the week. And starting Monday, we'll be giving away tickets to the Trampled by Turtles and Avett Brothers show that's happening in St. Paul on October 26th. We've got a slight chance of showers today with a mix of clouds and sun, high 60 to 64, lows tonight in the upper 40s. For tomorrow, sunny, high 72 to 75, breezy southwest winds 10 to 20. Looking ahead to Monday, mostly sunny, highs in the mid-70s. Coming up at 9 o'clock, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg. This week's stories from friends and neighbors about stranger encounters. And at 10 o'clock, Jerry Bredeman, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Right now, we continue with Weekend Edition from National Public Radio.